Welcome to Loco, a conversation podcast celebrating the stories of unconventional yet phenomenal single women expats. Today, I speak with Nicole Pearson, the woman and your Spanish wine expert and guide at Nicole Angela Travel and Taste. Okay, Nicole, thank you. I really appreciate you taking some time out of your busy schedule to join me today.
You're so welcome. It's absolutely my pleasure.
Introduce yourself and give me a bit of background and let me know where you're from and where you are.
My name is Nicole Angela Pearson, and I was born in the Bronx in New York City, but I grew up in Alaska. And I actually currently live and have lived for the past 13 years in Madrid, Spain, the capital of Spain. And I came here to study flamenco dance, and I stayed for the wine and excellent food.
You came for flamenco, so is that what inspired your move?
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. I have a very, it's kind of a strange story. When I was very young, living in Anchorage, Alaska, I was 12 or 13, I saw a movie on public television, in fact. A Spanish director named Carlos Saura had done a flamenco version of Carmen. And I actually came in the middle of the movie, and this woman, this young woman, is standing in front of a mirror, and she's really doing nothing more than moving her hands in this most amazing way. But she's looking at herself in the mirror with such incredible confidence and power. And I completely flipped out and just really kind of lost it. I felt like lightning had struck. I had seen something that I knew instinctively that I needed to know more about and to become a part of.
What is it about flamenco that you now know that moved you?
Actually, it was the power. It was the power of a woman and the way that she fully owned who she was and made no apologies for herself and expressed herself, warts and all. One of the most amazing things about flamenco is that it's actually a dance that rewards age. So as you are older, as you have more life experience, all of that only adds to the richness of your ability to dance. So I know that instinctively, I had never seen anything where I could see a young woman look so powerful and self-possessed. And when I came to study in Spain, all of my teachers were like, move those hips, get down in the ground, own this. You are a woman, own it. And it was a really powerful journey to study, actually.
It sounds like for those women who perhaps aren't as, tapped into their femininity, that it really sort of unleashed that.
Yeah, I mean, it makes no apologies for your femininity. And I guess one of the things I mean by that, the best flamenco dancers I've actually ever seen are older women who are in their 70s or even in their 80s, and their breasts are sagging and they've got these big bellies, and they just own and love and celebrate who they are. And to me, that is so powerful. And there are just so few spaces in the world where you see women celebrating themselves and being celebrated like that.
You know, what's really interesting is that you'll notice I didn't say sexuality.
Yeah.
And with you sort of affirming how these women come with their bodies as they are.
Yeah. And the sexiness comes from that, is that they know very well who they are. They own every single part of who they are, and they love it, and they love themselves. And really, when I started dancing, I obviously didn't know all of that. I was emotionally drawn literally to something. And over the years, and it's even in the way you practice it, flamenco is about improvisation. So it's just you in whatever moment you find yourself in. And, you know, there's something really, I studied dance all of my life, and I had never, ever in my life been invited to just so freely be and express who I was. That was a whole lesson that I had to learn, and it was very powerful.
I sensed that you had a background in the arts, and hearing that you came to it from a perspective as a dancer, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I was a dancer all of my life, actually. As a very young kid, I had a lot of energy, and I loved ballet. I fell in love with it very, very young. And so I was lucky enough to have parents who noticed that and really encouraged me in that direction. So yeah, that was a real foundation of me as a young person growing up.
Can I just back up for a minute? Because I think I overlooked that you're from Alaska. You're probably the second person I've ever spoken with that's from Alaska. What was Alaska like growing up?
You know, from my actual perspective, because now I have perspective as an adult and someone who's been away, I was born in New York City. So I personally felt robbed of not having a New York City childhood, which would have meant concerts. And, you know, I grew up right at the same time that hip hop was becoming a thing. And it's actually from the neighborhood where I was born. So I felt a little upset with my parents. But looking back on it, you know, there wasn't a better childhood in terms of being prepared to be out in the world than growing up in Alaska. Why? Because it's such wide open spaces. You know, as a young child, you're playing, you're out for hours, you're in the forest, you're on your own. And, you know, you learn very early how to be capable and take care of yourself in that way. And I think one of the things that people don't realize about Anchorage, where I grew up, it's like, it's always been an incredibly diverse city. To the extent that when I went to school in Washington, D.C., I went to Howard, I was shocked at how segregated D.C. was. I couldn't believe it. I grew up with Koreans, South Asians, people from various parts of Europe, people from England, Afro people from the diaspora, meaning folks from the Caribbean, as well as folks from the States. So I had an incredibly diverse childhood, and that was something that I had completely taken for granted until I went away to university and was completely shocked with what I saw. And when I talked to people, how limited their experiences were with other communities.
Being that Howard is an HBCU, did you choose it because of that?
Oh, I didn't actually choose it. My dad went and his cousin went, and I was actually accepted to another university. And my parents, my dad in particular, asked me to defer enrollment and to go to Howard for a year. So I thought, sure, no problem. And I went, and, you know, it was a completely transformative experience because, you know, growing up in Anchorage, Alaska, even though I grew up in an incredibly diverse sort of neighborhood and friendship circle, I didn't grow up with lots of other African Americans. And so the only African Americans I had a really close, intimate relationship with were my family, who lived on the other side of the country. So I did actually welcome it as an opportunity to be more connected, know more about, you know, a Black community. So I went for the year, and I was worried because I knew that I came from a very quote unquote white environment, and, you know, you can hear my voice now. I just didn't sound very convincingly Black, even to other Black people. So, I was a little worried when I went, like I didn't really know how to dance the way everyone else did and all of that. And it ended up being that so many other students from Howard were the same. We all came from these predominantly white or definitely non-African-American communities. And we all kind of shared the same fears. And so that was transformative. That was amazing. And so with that, I decided to stay.
Wow. That's a great story. Because I was like, well, how did she choose Howard? And but it's good to see that your father actually pushed that in a way.
Yeah.
It sort of helped you in ways that you probably could have never imagined. And I can relate, you know, as a woman who grew up in the South and not necessarily speaking like everyone else or like everyone else, I resonate with that as well. So we're just going to bring it back forward again and talk more about your time in Madrid.
Great.
Tell us about how you are able to stay there legally.
Well, that is actually quite an interesting journey, and it's actually one that sort of marks a very different period in terms of being an American and being abroad in Spain. So I moved to Spain in 2005, and when I moved, the truth was, as a U.S. citizen, right, with an American passport, I had a tremendous amount of privilege in the sense that nobody was really looking at me or for me, despite the fact that I was a Black woman. So I decided when I arrived that I would take my time and figure out how I wanted to stay long term. Well, actually, that's not even true. In the beginning, when I first moved to Spain, I didn't know that I was going to stay long term. I initially thought I was going to stay about 3 years. Long enough to really get flamenco under my belt, be able to have some dances to perform and to start teaching. But really in my second year, it became really apparent that I was incredibly comfortable and just loved Spain and was very excited about Spain, that I wasn't particularly interested in moving anywhere else. So that's when I decided, having had been here for 2 years, not legally, that in fact it wasn't a problem. So I didn't get my residency, in fact, until 3 years ago. Well, actually, now it's probably 4 years, 3.5 years ago. And wow. I got my residency right through my business. So my decision was then, well, instead of looking for a company to hire me, I'm going to create my own business. I'm going to, you know, the idea was really a little bit about, I wanted to make my reason to be here, right? I didn't want to be here for a relationship. I didn't want to be connected to this place. I'm getting emotional about it because this was so important to me, that I was going to create the reason for me to be here. And, you know, it took me 3 years. So I've had my residency for 3 years, but I, in fact, had been trying for 3 years prior to that. So it was over a three-year process to actually get residency through my business. But in the end, I was able to do so.
How is it that you were able to stay? Were you just sort of in and out of the country, like renewing a long stay? I mean, how were you able to navigate that space being, quote, illegal?
Well, but that's what I'm saying. As a U.S. citizen, there was nothing. No one was looking at me. No one... It didn't matter to anyone that I wasn't legal. So this is what, that's why I said, well, you know what? I'm going to take my time and I'm going to figure this out and I'm going to do it my way, because I felt really lucky to be able to use my privilege as a U.S. citizen to be able to do that.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So you have your permanent residency now. So walk us through the process of starting your business and sort of getting right on paper.
Well, the issue for me was that I was doing it in a way that was very unusual. The fact that I was going through my business meant that I had to have a business plan in Spanish. I had to show enough money in my bank account and that the business itself was economically viable. So the truth was, in Spain, culturally, entrepreneurship is not a thing, right? People are very invested in getting work through the state and getting lifetime work and all of these things. So part of the process, and I was very lucky, I had a wonderful lawyer who was with me through the entire process, who charged me my one-time fee for the residency, but worked with me over 3 years. And so there was a lot of interesting conversations that I had with a number of Spanish officials at various points who needed a bit of convincing that this was even a thing. It was nuts. I mean, really. Part of it is, I will say that I had another girlfriend who was doing something similar. So she was from California. We had both been here 10 years. for, you know, 7, 8, 9 years when we started our process. And so she started hers through her now very successful floral business. And I got mine, you know, through my burgeoning wine business. So because I had seen her do it, I also knew it was possible. I mean, I'm a stubborn person anyway, but I will say that it's incredibly valuable to have someone else who at least shares in the experience that you're going through.
Well, that's why I want to have you on, because that's what the show is about. It's about women who've done it themselves. They weren't reliant upon a job or a spouse or attending university. That's not what Loco is about. So I appreciate the story more than you know. And I'd love to meet the woman that you were able to model this from.
Yeah. I mean, well, let's talk, because I can definitely connect you to her. She's wonderful. And yes, I think I really appreciate what you're doing in this program because of that. Because, I mean, if it's not there, let's create it. Let's create that space. Let's create those networks where women do have the opportunity to see each other and to see us doing this stuff on our own, right? We can be wherever we want in the world. And all we have to do is see each other and love each other and be able to support each other, however we go about doing that.
Right. Okay. So let's talk about your wine business. Tell me about your business.
Sure. So my business got started by accident. I grew up in a family of wine and food aficionados. So I feel incredibly lucky to have had really two parents who were incredible cooks and who were just very passionate and interested in food. So I come to Spain to study flamenco dancing. I don't really know anything about Spanish wine or food. Well, I start to hear about food and this whole sort of gastronomic, popular stuff that's coming out of northern Spain, but I really don't know anything. I get a job with a theater company, traveling around doing shows in English, and I'm lucky enough to visit every part of Spain, of mainland Spain. That is, I didn't get to travel to the islands. And in there, I saw the incredible diversity and richness of Spanish wine and food. And I kind of lost it. I literally couldn't believe that no one was talking about it, particularly not Spanish people. Then I learned it's not really a cultural thing for them to do that, but I'm astonished. So I'm, you know, packing my suitcases with all kinds of wines and things to give to people and to just get people excited over this. And at the same time, I'm teaching English to make money. And a number of my students are really advanced students. So the English that they need isn't how to say your name or even write a basic email. They really need another level of being able to interact outside of work, outside of meetings. So I tell them, well, hey, why don't you guys just come over to my house? And we'll talk about Spanish wines. I'll run you through the wines. Because a number of Spanish folks said to me, oh, that's so interesting. I don't know anything about Spanish wines. And I'm like, are you kidding me? So it started very innocently in my house of just doing these simple tastings and my own research and wine courses in Spanish, actually, to learn more specific, more technical information about Spanish wines. And so from there, I just started throwing basically tasting parties. And I started collaborating with folks, a friend of mine who has a small art gallery and a piano. So I did some events with music and wine. But the emphasis was always on Spanish wine, because the public in general, Spanish or otherwise, has very little knowledge of the complete richness and diversity of Spanish wine. When we think about wine, we think about Italy and France, but, you know, between Italy and France is Spain. And they were actually a very important cradle of wine civilization in Europe going back for a millennia.
So what's the name of your business?
My business is called Nicole Angela Travel and Taste. So I focus on creating wine events that allow people who may not necessarily feel comfortable around wine, but have a sort of a casual curiosity and interest. In my business, we're interested in breaking down this wall of pretension around wine. So I spend a lot of time working with small family winemakers, and I created a three-step tasting process, which doesn't tell people what wines taste like, but helps them to figure out and articulate their sensation, their sense of what a wine is like. So, you know, basically the business is about bringing people closer together and connecting them to this very beautiful and natural and wonderful experience that is wine.
I'd like to get into what's happening in Madrid and get into your, well, to come at it from a local's perspective, to learn about things to do and, you know, all the happenings there in the city.
Sure.
Can you just give me a brief history about Madrid, what you know about it thus far? And then we'll go into like your favorite places to eat and have wine.
Sure. So Madrid is actually a very interesting city. It's the capital of Spain, although I think a lot of people outside of Spain don't necessarily realize that. A lot of people think it's Barcelona. And Madrid was initially an Arab city. Well, not Arab, it was a Muslim city. So there was a caliphate that actually created what we call Madrid. And we know this because the founders of the city are buried, and their bodies, they're buried in a huge basilica in the center of Madrid, and their bodies are facing Mecca. So one of the very interesting things about Spain, which won't be talked about very much in Madrid, is the Islamic layer of history in Madrid. But that would be because after the Spanish Civil War, which officially ends in 1939, the capital is taken over by Spanish fascists, who are not interested in talking anything about that Islamic past. So Madrid is actually kind of a strange place in the sense that you can see visually some very interesting Islamic elements, but these things don't get talked about. Outside of that, it's a capital. I think it's the smallest of the European capitals, if I'm not mistaken. The center of Madrid is walkable. It's one of my favorite things about the city is that you actually don't even need to take public transportation. In the center of Madrid, anywhere you want to go is a 20-minute, maybe a 30-minute walk. It's become a city of bikes, so there's quite a bit of biking happening. It's always been quite a cultural capital in terms of music and dance and art. And in fact, the museums in Madrid are some of the best museums in all of Europe. The Reina Sofia is one of the best modern art museums in Europe. And the Prado Museum is one of the best classical art museums in all of Europe. And they have exquisite pieces of Spanish art history.
Before you go any further, so what's one thing, because I'm going to get into the whole thing about the galleries and the art culture there, mm-hmm. but what's the one thing you'd say Madrid is known for?
It's nightlife. There's nothing like it on the planet.
Oh, wow. Okay.
No, there is nothing like it on the planet. We don't eat dinner till 9 or 10, so we're not going out until midnight.
For, let's say, let's get into your favorite place to have breakfast or brunch.
I am very picky and I'm a really good cook. So I do a lot of cooking at home and I'm not really a brunch person. I know people are really into that, but I'm really Spanish in that sense of like, so I don't really do those kinds of things. Sorry.
Let me back up for a minute. So, because you, when you say I'm really Italian, I'm really Spanish in that way. So Spain resonates as home for you.
Yes, absolutely. And it did almost from the first moment that I arrived, actually.
Can you go into that a bit?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, I arrive in 2005, and I arrive in a particular neighborhood in the center of Madrid called Lavapiés. And this is a very, very special neighborhood. Time Out magazine unfortunately called it the coolest neighborhood in the world. and I'm a little sad about that. But one of the reasons why it possibly is because it has welcomed people into its community. And I was immediately welcomed there, right? After only being there a week, you know, you go to a butcher to get your meats, you go to a greengrocer to actually get your vegetables, and they know who you are. And they're like, hey, what are you doing today? How's it going? How's your friend? Because I came in with a friend one time and they saw my friend. So I was so smitten by that. And actually, the truth is, in Madrid, I don't know of any other neighborhood that would have been that welcoming and that aware of my presence even. And I feel like that's really special and is one of the things that makes that neighborhood so special. But beyond that, I mean, Madrid in 2005 was to me like New York City in the 90s. So, you know, in the early 90s, in fact. So it's a little bit scruffy looking, right? It's not your prettiest city, but people are amazing. They interact with you. They're just wonderful. There's that kind of graffiti. I mean, it really was nuts. I kind of felt like I had gone back into a time machine in a way. And just very natural and completely unpretentious. And I loved it. I loved it. It was just like being in my grandma's neighborhood in Brooklyn. Well, I mean, and then the other thing is there's just a way about Spaniards. I don't know how to say this. Well, I actually saw something identifiably Black in a lot of Spanish people. I was like, these are the blackest white people I've ever seen. Why are they so Black? I don't understand. Okay. Meaning that they are going to tell you how it is. They're not trying to hurt your feelings. They really are just going to tell you. And it's just sort of this way of expressing themselves that I just immediately resonated with and really made a lot of sense to me. And then subsequently in research that I've done about Spain in general, it turns out that Spain is one of only two countries in Europe that ever had a sizable sub-Saharan African population in its major cities. So there's a reason for that.
It's in the blood. It's in the earth.
It's somewhere. And as a lot of my Spanish friends say, they're like, well, we're also next to Africa. So let's not all be surprised. But again, not all Spanish people. This is a very interesting discussion. White Spaniards are comfortable with that. Most of my friends are, but I do understand that there are Spanish people who want to distance themselves from that in the way that Franco did over the 40 years of his dictatorship.
Okay. Well, I guess we won't touch that today.
Yeah, no, that girl, we do not have time.
Right. So getting back to your favorites. So you don't have a favorite breakfast place and you're not really into cafe culture, or are you?
So when I first came here, like cafe culture in that sense of, I think a more American sense, didn't really exist here. I mean, you had like the old sort of bohemian, wonderfully dark places where people would talk over intellectual topics for hours. And that was it for me. I was like, oh, this is a dream. So yeah, that sort of cheery cafe culture didn't exist in the first almost 10 years that I was here. So I basically kind of left it. I didn't really miss it. And it was fine. I'm really always just more focused on wine. Where I can get a good glass of wine.
Okay. Places for casual dining, an upscale restaurant you can recommend?
Well, so dining here is a completely different thing again. For example, on a Saturday night or Sunday night, people don't necessarily have full meals. You actually have tapas.
Tapas.
Mm-hmm. So food here always comes with wine. You're never just served wine. You always get food. And again, fabulous. That is absolutely what wine is about. It's about being with your friends and having a little bit to eat and just enjoying that experience. And so I adore Spain for really pioneering that.
Well, give me places to visit for wine, places to get nice tapas and great Spanish wine.
Sure. So one of my favorite places is in Malasaña, and it's called Divino. And it's on Calle Palma, and it's run by an amazing woman from Valenciana woman named Yolanda. And not only is it a beautiful older space, it also has an incredible selections of wines from all over Spain and a really nice selection of wines from various places in Europe. It's just a very well curated wine list, and she plays amazing music. It's a very comfortable, kind of classy, but really relaxed space. So that is a big, big favorite of mine. There's one more place I want to mention. It's called Bar Amor, and it's also in my neighborhood of Malasaña, and it's the most adorable space run by a couple. And again, they are really committed to having a super diverse Spanish wine list, and they do exquisite tapas that have a little bit of a modern twist to them. Again, they're super lovely. It's not a very big space, but it's very comfortable, and the food and the wine is exquisite. It's a very sweet place.
So getting back to your favorite neighborhood, what was it again? And tell me about it a bit more.
Lavapiés. So Lavapiés is a working class neighborhood in the center of Madrid, and it really is the coolest neighborhood in the entire world, simply because it's a neighborhood of immigrants, of people from all walks of life. It's a neighborhood that's always been an activist neighborhood filled with art. And in fact, art spaces that are completely run and organized by the neighbors. So not state run, neighborhood run. So they have skateboard ramps, they've got gardens, they've got, you know, woodworking places. I can't really express to you how special that neighborhood is. I do a tour of that neighborhood, and I did one just yesterday with a group of university students from Tufts, because it's a beautiful shining example of what a neighborhood really could be, in the sense that you're seen and you're loved and you're noticed there. I don't live there anymore. I haven't lived in that neighborhood for the past 5 years, but every time I go into that neighborhood, someone is like, "Nicole, how are you? Where are you? What's going on?" And I go into that neighborhood, and it always feels like home. The struggle of that neighborhood right now is going through a really intense cycle of gentrification. So unfortunately, some of that history of that neighborhood is being erased, but the neighborhood is filled with a bunch of stellar, I don't know, social justice fighters and warriors. And I'm talking about people who are abuelas, who are grandmas. So it's a whole range of people who are just passionate about creating spaces and being in places where everyone gets to be. That's my favorite neighborhood.
So let's get into the culture of the place. Let's talk about those museums and art galleries. And what's your favorite museum or gallery?
The amazing thing about Spain, and I think it's really unfortunate that Spain gets only known for its beaches, is that it has, and it always has had, an incredible visual arts culture. I mean, Picasso, Dalí, they're from Spain. They're Spanish. And, you know, the classical Velázquez, Goya, you know, it's always had an incredible, brilliant visual art scene. And, you know, it continues to have one because Madrid itself has so many galleries and so many amazing museums. I am always flabbergasted by the sheer number of openings and exhibitions that go on here. It really is a hallmark of Spanish culture that I don't think has ever been talked about enough. Mapfre is an insurance company that has two brilliant galleries, one that does rotating large exhibitions, like when Givenchy's exhibition of his work came through, and they house that, but they do a lot of photography as well. And I'm talking more contemporary photographers from all over the world. There's a lot of music in Madrid as well, a lot of jazz and a lot of blues here. There's a whole blues society in Madrid that's pretty amazing. I'm always shocked at the depth of talent that they get, because it's not even necessarily the most well-known names, but it's some of the best, most interesting younger performers coming out of the States. So Spain is a really, really keen on music.
Are there any particular jazz clubs that you'd recommend?
There's Bogey Jazz, which gets a lot of the younger talent, and that's a really fun place. There's another place in Seoul, which is the center that I'm drawing a blank on right now, and that's a classic place where Chick Corea, Herbie Hancock, like all the heavy hitters have played at. That's Cafe Central. It's kind of really a bit too touristy for my taste, but they still get a really stellar collection of like older established jazz musicians there.
If I were visiting, where would I get information about them?
Probably your best bet is to look in El País. El País has like a whole section of culture. So go online and look at El País. El País is also in English. They have an English version.
Okay, perfect. So I want to get into your tours, learn more about those. But also, I'd like to ask first, what's a great day trip from Madrid that, say again, if I were visiting, that you think, okay, you should do this?
That depends on what you're looking for. But I would always say go into the mountains, because what I think that people don't realize is that Madrid is actually fairly high altitude-wise. We are surrounded by mountain ranges. And so I think what people don't really know is that we're much closer to nature than people realize. And you can actually get on a train and go to some really cute mountain villages and go hiking and have a delicious lunch. Yeah, so Cercedilla is one of the places I would recommend for a day trip. And that's really getting into some mountains and doing some nice hiking. Another place I would recommend is El Escorial, which is actually a beautiful, beautiful mountain village with a huge monastery and just a spectacular sort of day walking around trip. So those are two off the top of my head I would absolutely recommend. And it's definitely worth it to get out, and it's super easy. You don't even need a car. You can just get on a train. And in a half an hour, 45 minutes, you will be in the mountains.
Okay, sounds fantastic. We're coming to the end, but before we do, I'd like to have you tell us about your tours.
Sure. So my tours are based on relationships that I develop with winemakers. So my tours are to family-owned and run smaller production wineries. And they showcase a lot of organic and starting now biodynamic wines. And they really are wines that represent the area where they're from. So I'm really, really proud, because it's super important for me that people have a wine experience that is completely natural and unpretentious. And that's the kind of tour and experience that I'm offering. And I'm able to share with people wines that they won't necessarily have access to in any other way. And the idea is really to grow communities of wine aficionados and winemakers. Because, you know, these are people who have families and histories who simply love what they're doing. But more than that, they love sharing what they have. And anyone who's at all interested, it doesn't matter if you have a ton of experience or none at all, just having an enthusiasm and openness to try different things. So my tours are really fun. Come to my tours. I do walking tours in Madrid as well. So I do walking tours within the city of important places for different kinds of wines, vermouth tours. Vermouth is a whole other world that no one knows about outside of Spain, but vermouth is a very popular pre-dinner or pre-meal drink that you have that has a huge history here. Yeah, but I think...
That vermouth?
Yes, it's vermouth. So it's not what you're thinking, because everyone thinks about Martini and Rossi and that terrible Italian stuff. Spanish vermouth is its own whole world, and it's absolutely amazing. It's a fortified wine, so it's quite strong, but it's not meant to be drunk like wine. It's in a smaller glass. It has ice and orange or lemon and olive.
Sounds great.
It's fantastic. Wow. The most adorable, gussied up old ladies. That's how I discovered vermouth in Madrid. I saw these amazing women on Saturday afternoons getting all gussied up in their little groups, and they would go up to a bar and they would order this drink, this dark drink in a short glass, and it was always a lemon or orange and an olive in it. And I was like, what the hell is that? And so I decided I had to try this because these women were amazing. They'd be laughing, having the time of their life. And I mean elder women. I'm talking women in their 60s and 70s and maybe in their 80s. These whole girl gangs of like elders. So I tried it and I was like, why didn't any of my Spanish friends tell me about this? And they started laughing at me, being like, you mean what my grandma drinks? And I'm like, your grandma's right. Why are you not listening to your grandma? Everyone should listen to their grandma. And so I started to become obsessed and researching and found a number of amazing vermouth bars.
So do you get gussied up to go and have some vermouth?
Oh, I do. And I get girls to go with me. I'm like, come on, girl, let's do this. Yes.
Great. Okay, Nicole, you have to tell us where we can find you to book tours.
Great. You can find me on Facebook. And you can actually find me online. I did a search for myself the other day when I typed in Nicola Angela Travel and Taste, and I came up immediately. So it was very gratifying. Feel free on Facebook to send me questions or ask me anything. People do. It's really fun. And I love helping you out.
And what's your website?
It's Nicola Angela Travel and Taste.
Well, it was an absolute pleasure. This was such a great talk. I really appreciate you taking time. I really, really do.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I do feel really honored that you asked me. And again, I love the work that you're doing. So any way that I can become part of the community and be a resource to other people as well, I'm really happy to do it. So thank you.
Okay, thanks for tuning in today. I hope you found this local's perspective informative and even inspiring. If so, please consider subscribing to Loco using iTunes or your favorite Android podcast player. If you have any comments or questions or even a story you'd like to submit, please connect with us at loco.co, that's L-O-C-A-U-X.co. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time.